Buongiorno, grazie a tutti per essere qui. Il nostro seminario di oggi è ridotto nel numero dei relatori, ma questo non gli ha certamente fatto perdere interesse. Il tema del quale andiamo a discutere oggi è tutto fuorché periferico, anche nella discussione politica ed economica di questi giorni, è per l'appunto il tema dell'assicurazione sui depositi. Il titolo che abbiamo dato al seminario di questa mattina è Le conseguenze inintenzionali della profilassi, il che vi dà un'idea, del genere di cornice intellettuale nella quale cercheremo di mettere l'assicurazione sui depositi. Per alcuni anni abbiamo discusso intensamente di azzardo morale. Curiosamente negli ultimi tempi l'intera categoria dell'azzardo morale è scomparsa dagli articoli dei grandi quotidiani, dalle riflessioni che gli economisti fanno in pubblico. A me era molto piaciuto un articolo di Larry Summers sul Financial Times in cui diceva "Beware the moral hazard fundamentalist". E a dire il vero pensavo che il fondamentalista dell'azzardo morale, di tutte le etichette che ci appiccicano addosso, a me non dispiaceva francamente rispetto ad altri. Di queste cose parliamo stamattina con Larry White, è un piacere averlo qui. Larry tra l'altro capisce benissimo l'italiano, quindi devo stare attento a ciò che dico. Oggi insegna economia alla George Mason University, che è uno dei pochi centri al mondo nel quale l'economia austriaca è viva e devo dire straordinariamente feconda negli ultimi anni anche rispetto alla produzione di giovani studiosi. Questa è una scuola, dopo tutto, cioè non semplicemente una biblioteca, una collezione di testi, ma anche una comunità intellettuale in crescita. Ha studiato Harvard, che è una cosa curiosa per un liberale, ma capita ogni tanto. È probabilmente la maggiore autorità internazionale sui temi del free banking e sulla storia del gold standard. Il suo ultimo libro però non riguarda questioni tecniche di politica monetaria, nonostante abbia scritto recentemente, sia stato uno dei tre autori di un paper molto importante e per fortuna molto discusso, che tracciava un bilancio storico dell'operato della Federal Reserve, la quale è stata, per citare un sostenitore del central banking, cioè Milton Friedman, forse una delle istituzioni la cui reputazione è più esagerata nella storia della modernità. Ma il suo ultimo libro invece attiene questioni di storia del pensiero economico ed è un bellissimo libro che mi permetto di consigliarvi, a qualcuno l'ho anche regalato, che è The Clash of Economic Ideas, che è uscito da Cambridge University Press e ha il pregio di essere un libro ricchissimo di informazioni ma anche molto bello da leggere. Ogni capitolo comincia con una vignetta, con una storia, permettendoci poi di situare il dibattito intellettuale del Novecento all'interno di quel secolo così intenso e talora così tragicamente intenso di eventi politici che il Novecento è stato. È un libro molto bello, così come sono sempre illuminanti gli articoli di Larry, che tra le altre cose è una Young Scholar al Cato Institute, del quale potete trovare online anche una produzione importante di articoli più semplici, più popolari, ma utili per mettere a fuoco questi temi e anche lo spazio che hanno avuto perlomeno nella storia di una certa parte della riflessione economica. E con questo, ringraziandolo molto di essere qui e ringraziando assieme a lui anche George Selgin, che ha avuto l'idea di questo seminario, gli cedo la parola per parlare delle conseguenze inintenzionali della profilassi.
Grazie, buongiorno, grazie per essere qui And now the Italian ends. Thank you for coming. I extend on George Selgin's behalf his apologies for being unable to be here. I wanted to mention to Alberto that the Italian translation rights of The Clash of Economic Ideas are still available. But I've been asked to talk about deposit insurance, and the subtitle, The Unintended Consequences of Prophylaxis, was Alberto's. I've never used the word prophylaxis in my life. But I looked it up, so I think I know what it means. So I'll talk somewhat about the theory of deposit insurance and then about the historical experience we've had with deposit insurance. And given what I know, I will talk more about the United States than other countries. Forgive me for that. But the theory, and the United States was the first big country to have national deposit insurance, and it has since spread to the rest of the world with some unfortunate consequences. But the leading argument in favor of deposit insurance and some other interventions into the banking system has become the problem of bank runs. And bank runs were a problem in the United States in the 1930s. So the argument goes something like this. I split it into three parts, which is a little bit arbitrary, but helps organize the discussion. First, the factual proposition that if you have an unregulated banking system, it will be fragile. You'll have runs and panics. I guess I have to make a normative statement. More often than you'd like. Too many runs and panics. Secondly, that runs and panics are regrettable events. Right? They have harmful spillover effects. And then third, that there's something we can do about it, something that policy can do about it, and where the benefit of reducing the number of runs and panics exceeds the cost of doing so. I'm going to first say a little about the second claim, which is relatively uncontroversial. We could all understand how bank runs can be unfortunate and how we'd rather live in a banking system that has fewer runs than in one that has more runs. So that's relatively uncontroversial. I'm going to question the first part and the third part, though. I think the evidence indicates that banking systems are not inherently prone to runs and panics. When there are historical examples of systems that have been prone to runs and panics, we have to look for a reason that distinguishes them from the systems that haven't been prone to runs and panics. And I think the reason lies in legal restrictions that have weakened the banks in those systems. And then third, I'll talk about the question of whether deposit insurance passes a cost-benefit test, whether it reduces runs in the most cost-effective way. So first I want to modify my agreement with part B, which is to say not all runs are harmful. If a bank is insolvent, then it needs to be closed because it's wasting resources. And a run that closes an insolvent bank, if there's no other mechanism for closing an insolvent bank, is a good thing. It cuts the losses. It stops the bleeding. It brings the problem to an end. Now, it's a little bit messy, right? In other lines of business, we have bankruptcy procedures which put a stop to the losses and divide them among the creditors. In a bank run, the creditors get their money in the order they line up. And some at the beginning of the line get more than those at the end of the line. So there might be a better way to do that, but maybe not. Having it on a first-come, first-serve system does give the right incentives to depositors to keep an eye on what the bank is doing. Because if everybody gets an equal share, then nobody has an incentive to pay attention. Um, So it's a real problem if nobody closes an insolvent bank. And we had this problem in the United States. It was called the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s. Two-thirds of our savings banks became insolvent because interest rates shot up. They had portfolios, which they were required to hold by law, consisting 95% of long-term fixed-rate mortgages. And when interest rates shoot up, the mortgages don't start earning more, but they had to start paying more for their deposits. So they were paying 9-10% interest to fund old mortgages, paying them 6%. They quickly became insolvent. On a present value basis, they immediately became insolvent. And the regulators didn't close them because they were wishfully thinking that they could recover. That didn't work out so well. A negative equity gap of about $10 billion turned into $150 billion because of the delay. The banks that were insolvent just took bigger risks to try to recover, and they just got farther and farther into red ink. So if the regulators are asleep at the switch, that's a terrible outcome. So we'd rather have people running on banks that are insolvent than have that. The problem, of course, is that sometimes depositors run on a bank that's not insolvent because they don't have perfect information about whether the bank is insolvent. They can't directly observe that. And so that's the regrettable kind of bank run, when it happens on a solvent bank and imposes losses on shareholders, on other depositors, and on borrowers from the bank who have to take their business somewhere else. So it becomes a historical question, empirical question, how often that actually happens. Okay, let's go to the theory that banks are inherently fragile. This is sometimes called a sunspot theory. The term sunspot theory comes from William Stanley Jevons, who had a serious theory of the business cycle that said business cycles are correlated with the appearance of literal sunspots on the surface of the sun, because that affects agriculture and that somehow causes a business cycle. Other economists thought that was such a ridiculous theory that they've given the label sunspots to any theory that posits a cause that's completely unbelievable, implausible. So a sunspot theory says that runs could be triggered by anything that makes people think there will be a run. And it's a coherent theory, it's logically coherent, because anything that makes people think there will be a run, if I think other people are going to run the bank, I want to get there first, so I will run. And so the belief that there will be a run becomes self-justifying. If we think there will be a run, there will be a run. So, and there will be a run because if everybody wants to withdraw, we can't all do it. It's first come, first serve. This is sometimes called the me first problem. Everybody wants to get there first. Now, what are the empirical implications? What kind of patterns should we see if that's the general or typical kind of bank run? They could happen anytime, anywhere that people lose faith for whatever reason. It doesn't have to be driven by fundamentals. So it suggests either a random pattern or that there's some kind of non-fundamental cause that leads to clusters of bank runs. And this idea has been formalized most famously by Diamond and Dibvig, but it's a much older idea. You can find, actually in Thomas Jefferson, a letter to somebody saying, people think that they can get silver for their banknotes, and two or three people might, but if everybody asks for it, they can't get it. And all that will cause more than three people to ask for it is the perception that they can't all get it. So, you know, the banks are skating on very thin ice. So he already had this idea that they were very fragile. Now, there's a problem with this prediction of the theory, which is it doesn't match the facts. It's usually a problem with a prediction. It doesn't explain the historical patterns we do see in bank runs. Bank runs are not random events. Panics are not random events. In the system that had the biggest problem with panics in the United States, the banking panics in the late 19th century took place at the beginning, or shortly after the downturn of a business cycle, so very early in the recession phase. So we need some way to explain that, and saying that bank runs are random won't explain that pattern. And then secondly, there's a geographic problem, which is you don't see runs in all fractional reserve banking systems, as the theory predicts. You see some countries like the US having a problem with panics. England had problems with runs among the country banks, but you don't see a problem in Canada, you don't see a problem in Scotland. So we need to explain how these systems were different, but it can't be inherent to banking that there are going to be panics. And as I said a minute ago, it's we need to look at the regulatory how the regulatory systems differed between these countries. So a better theory that fits these patterns has been called the bad news theory of bank runs. That is, people aren't triggered to run the bank just out of fear that other people will run for whatever reason, but rather out of information that leads them to believe that the bank is already insolvent. Right? Now, that information may be a noisy signal. They may get it wrong sometimes, but they have some reasonable information that tells them that the bank is in trouble. And if that's true, then there already isn't enough to pay all the depositors back. And those who get there first will get paid back, and those who get there last won't. So it pays to run. So that helps explain why we see it at the beginning of recessions. The economic historian Gary Gorton did a study of the U.S. banking panics in which he found that by constructing an index of business bankruptcies, he could retroactively predict when the panic was going to occur. If the bankruptcy index got above a certain level, there would be a banking panic. If it didn't, there wouldn't be a banking panic. And the inference is people would read the newspaper. It said the local cotton mill is closing its doors. The bank in that town has a big share of its loan portfolio to that cotton mill and other cotton mills. In the United States, banking was not branched, so local banks lent heavily to local businesses. So if the local businesses are in trouble, then the local bank is in trouble. And then people would rationally run on all the local banks. I think the bad news theory also helps explain why you see geographic differences. In countries where the banks were adequately capitalized, you could read the news that a business was and well diversified. You could read that a business was failing and not worry about the bank because the bank had many more customers and it was loaned to many other industries. And that was the case where there weren't barriers to banks branching out and diversifying. So in Canada, banks were branched nationwide. In the US, they were all very local. In Scotland, banks were free to have as much capital as they wanted. In England, they were restricted to having six partners. So those kinds of regulatory differences explain the pattern. It's not consistent with bank runs being inherent to all banking systems. Now, this isn't just an argument that's of relevance to 19th century banking historians. This argument goes on about whether runs and run-like events are triggered by bad news or by sunspots. And you see it in the East Asian exchange rate crisis of the late 1990s. Jeff Sachs declared that there's no fundamental reason for people to be running on these exchange rate systems. Right, so each of the central banks had a fixed exchange rate to the US dollar. Speculators said, well, that's not going to last. They don't have enough dollars to pay everybody back. And they demanded redemption, and the central banks ran out of dollar reserves and had to devalue. Right, that's very much like a bank run. So his view was this was just an irrational investor panic. There was nothing fundamental going on. But if you actually look at the news, there is news that triggers these runs on the exchange rate systems. There's news in the Philippines, for example, that the government says we're going to bail out all the commercial banks that are in trouble. And if you did the mathematics, you would say they're going to issue too much money to maintain the exchange rate. And at that point, you get your dollars out. And it's in the argument over the financial crisis on Wall Street in 2008. So famously, Bear Stearns couldn't roll over its funding. They didn't have depositors in the usual sense, small savers, but they were borrowing billions of dollars overnight, every night. And when their creditors said, I don't think I'm going to roll that over tonight, that's like a bank run. There's a sudden stop to their credit. And why did the creditors do that? Well, they had information that indicated to them that Bear Stearns was probably insolvent. And when the authorities stepped in and over the weekend closed Bear Stearns and then brought in all the potential buyers and said, who would like to buy Bear Stearns? Here, take a look at the books. They all looked at the books and said, Bear Stearns is insolvent. If you want us to take over Bear Stearns, you're going to have to pay us. And the Federal Reserve Bank of New York ended up paying J.P. Morgan to take over Bear Stearns. Same thing happened when Lehman Brothers closed a few months later. By the way, the fact that the creditors in Bear Stearns were bailed out led the creditors of Lehman Brothers to say, oh, no risk here. And Lehman Brothers actually leveraged up more after Bear Stearns was closed or sold. But when Lehman was closed, it was so insolvent that nobody wanted to buy it without a subsidy too large, even for the Federal Reserve. But the important point is they were both insolvent. It wasn't an irrational panic. It was a very rational decision by the creditors to stop rolling over the funds. Freddie Mac, by the way, lost $5 billion when Lehman closed because they had lent them that much the night before. So if we step back and ask what makes a bank account run prone, it's a matter of the structure, how the contract is structured. Right? Depositors or creditors are rational. There has to be a greater payoff to demanding payment now rather than waiting. So that implies you have a debt claim. Right? That is, the amount you can get back doesn't vary with the portfolio of the bank. It's not that if the bank suffers losses, you say, well, I've suffered a loss. What you say is, I have to get there before everybody else. So you've got a debt claim for a fixed number of dollars. You're allowed to redeem on demand without any conditions, unconditionally redeemable on demand, which practically implies whoever gets there first gets to redeem first. And then the third condition that makes it rational is the last person in line is not going to get a full payback. So whether because the bank is already insolvent or the attempt to meet the earlier redeemers is going to turn them insolvent. So those are the kind of features the Dimon-Divig model has, which has made it popular. But I'll talk about the ways you can modify and banks did modify the contract so that it wasn't this run prone. I know Alberto is leaving this afternoon for the Galapagos Islands, where Charles Darwin famously studied. And there's kind of a Darwinian point to be made here, which is if you look at the sweep of banking history, starting in Lombardia, of course, how was it that banking spread and survived for centuries before anybody thought of deposit insurance? It's hard to reconcile that with the idea that it's an inherently fragile banking business model that could and will collapse at any time. So banks did have some way of making themselves less run prone. But the Dimon-Divig model pictures a bank that's very run prone. And I don't want to get into the sort of mathematical details of it, but I'll just detail the ways in which it's not like a real bank, and therefore we shouldn't take its lessons too seriously. It's a so-called bank that doesn't provide any payment services and doesn't have any shareholders. There's only one kind of claimant, and the claimant has a debt claim. The bank lives for three periods. You put your money in the first period. In the second period, you have a fixed debt claim. You're entitled to get back a certain number of dollars. Everybody is. And the total claims always exceed what the bank can pay at that moment. And then if the bank survives to the end, then you become a residual claimant. What the bank is worth is shared among all the claimants. All right, so it's a very strange debt equity hybrid, but the first strange thing about it is there's no class of equity holders who insulate depositors from losses. And that's the purpose, I mean, that's the function of shareholders. They provide a cushion. If the bank loses up to its equity, the depositors don't suffer, the shareholders only suffer. Not until the bank becomes insolvent do the shareholders begin to suffer. But the Diamond Dibvig Bank is always insolvent in the period in which the run is a threat. As I said, what it issues are not checking accounts. So what it's providing actually is a kind of insurance service. Diamond and Dibvig proposed that deposit insurance is a way of preventing runs. And what deposit insurance means in their setup is the promise that everybody who wants to withdraw will get the same amount. And that changes running on the bank from a dominant strategy to a dominated strategy. You might as well wait and see, because if too many people claim redemption more than the bank can pay, then the redemptions come to a stop. Everybody who got money out early is asked to give back, and then everything gets divided up among all the claimants. So there's no incentive any longer to be at the head of the line. Right? Well, so the deposit insurance scheme then violates what they call the sequential service constraint. That is, it undoes the first come, first serve rule. Well, if there's an agency that can undo the first come, first serve rule, why can't the bank undo the first come, first serve rule? In that case, you don't need an outside government agency to implement this kind of clawback system, right, where the early withdrawers are asked to give their money back and then it will be divided up evenly. If you can do that by contract, you don't need deposit insurance coming from the outside. And if you can't do that by contract, because once you give people the money, they consume it, let's say, how is it feasible for the government to implement this clawback? So that's an inconsistency that sort of undermines their attempt to picture deposit insurance as, in their system, it's costless. There's no cost to having this deposit insurance scheme because it's never used. It's never used because it would only be used if there were a run, but it reassures people that there won't be a run. And a run is the only thing that ever brings the bank down. The bank is never insolvent unless there's a run. That's the structure of their model. Okay? So it's this sort of immaculate deposit insurance scheme that has no costs, only benefits. And fourth, although they talk casually in their paper about panics, their model only has one bank. So it's got nothing about communication of runs from one bank to other banks. It's all about one bank. And that one bank, I mean, in a real world system, one bank that has a liquidity problem can borrow from other banks or from its clearinghouse. They can't allow that. There's only one bank. Okay, but what they conclude is, from this rather abstract model, is that banks are inherently run prone. Deposit insurance is not only cost effective, it's cost free. And there's no other way to handle the problem. I mean, one traditional way for banks to handle the problem has been to suspend payments. When banks say, look, if I tried to liquidate all my assets now, I would have to take low prices for them. And so you as a depositor don't really want me to do that. So let's suspend payments. Let's make you wait. Then we'll have time to sell the assets, get more money for them, and then we'll be able to pay everybody. And so that was the rationale behind suspending payments. You can't do that in the Diamond Dibvig model because what people have are not payment, not checking accounts, but they've deposited the one good in the economy, which is what they need to eat. So if you suspend payments, then people starve. Okay? That's why it's important that what the bank is issuing is not money, but claims to a consumption good. Okay. So what did banks do historically? Let me know when I need to wrap up. To make their accounts non-run prone. Well, any of the three conditions I said could be modified to make, and it takes the combination of all three. So if you modify any one, you make the bank non-run prone. I'm not going to say run proof, but not run prone. The first condition was that claimants are have debt claims, and you could modify that by making them equity claims. That is, you could say to depositors, here's your account balance based on today's portfolio value. If the portfolio goes down 10%, your account value goes down 10%. If you do that, then the depositors no longer have an incentive to withdraw because it's too late to avoid losses. That's a mutual fund, right, or a unit trust. And how is that relevant to banking? Well, since the 1970s, mutual funds have provided checking account services. They've allowed people to write checks on their account balances, which makes them very much serve the same function as a bank account. But that, of course, is not, and so that's an alternative. In a world without deposit insurance, people would find mutual funds a safer way to put their, arrange their checking accounts. That's not what banks did historically, of course. That's a mutual fund, not a bank. Banks did the second and third things. Either they modified the unconditional redeemability by giving themselves the contractual right to suspend payments. Economists like Friedman and Schwartz who say, well, the bank suspended payments and that was a good thing because it put an end to the contraction. Well, if it's a good thing, why wouldn't people agree to it up front, ex ante, and put it in the bank contract that the bank has the right to suspend payments under certain conditions where the alternative would be worse? Banks actually did that. They put notice of withdrawal clauses in their accounts that said, if we have to, we can ask you to wait 90 days to get your money back. In Scotland, some banks actually put it on their banknotes. This banknote will pay you £10 sterling, or at the option of the bank directors, £10 sterling plus interest 6 months from the day you ask for redemption. And that was an interesting system, very rarely used because it was bad for the bank's reputation to invoke this option. But if the alternative was the bank was going to have to borrow money on very steep terms or sell assets at very low prices to pay everybody, then they would invoke the clause. But it was incentive compatible because it said, we'll pay you interest. Normally, they didn't pay interest on banknotes, so they didn't want to invoke the clause. It was costly to do that. And the customers knew that the bank didn't want to invoke the clause. These were not legal in all countries. So the most important thing, in fact, they were outlawed in Scotland after they'd been used once. The most important thing that banks did was to issue what I call solvency assurances. That is, they changed the third condition by persuading their depositors that they could absorb losses. So they had enough capital and they were well diversified. Before deposit insurance, I don't know what banks did here, but in the United States, banks used to paint in their window, in gold paint usually, this bank has $5 million capital. When the Federal Deposit Insurance came along, they hired somebody to scrape that off and put in the sticker that says protected by the federal government. But those two are substitutes. When banks did not have deposit insurance, they had voluntarily 20% capital ratios. Since the onset of deposit insurance, they don't need capital to reassure their customers that the deposits are safe. So they don't like to hold capital. And how much capital do they hold? Well, it declined to about 3% until the Federal Deposit Insurance Agency said, well, now we're at risk. So they began imposing capital requirements on banks. And of course, the Basel agreements are all about central banks, bank regulators from around the world saying, we all need to have the same level of capital requirements so that we don't have competition. That would be terrible. Banks invested much more conservatively in those days. You couldn't go to a commercial bank that issued banknotes because it knew that it had liquid liabilities, it had to have liquid assets, and get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. That was too dangerous for them. If you wanted a mortgage, you had to go to a savings bank whose deposits were long-term deposits. You may be familiar with one of the famous bank run scenes in movie history, which is from It's a Wonderful Life, where Jimmy Stewart is running a savings bank, and some of his customers get worried. And it's not a sunspot run. It's a fundamental run. Uncle Joe got drunk and lost $8,000, and the word gets out. So they know the bank's insolvent. And they come and say, I want my money back. And Jimmy Stewart gives a speech about, I can't give you your money, Bill, because it's in Ted's house. But what he should have said was, look at the terms of your contract. It says your deposit's not due for 3 years. The other famous bank run in movie history is in the film Mary Poppins. Is that popular here? In the U.S., if you have kids, you've seen it many times. That's a sunspot run. But I don't have time to show you the film clip. And the bank in Mary Poppins responds in the very worst way, which is they immediately shut the windows when they had plenty of money to pay everybody in the bank lobby. Okay, so banks invested more conservatively in assets that had less default risk, less interest rate risk, the shorter term assets, and were much more liquid. So the typical bank asset was commercial paper, or what they called bills of exchange, right? 90-day IOUs issued by business firms to finance their inventories that had a large secondary market. So a bank could quickly replenish its reserves by selling off these assets, something it's hard to do, or at least used to be hard to do with mortgages. Third thing that you find in some countries is extended liability for shareholders. And this is an idea which is starting to make a comeback, that, you know, too big to fail and deposit insurance means that the depositors aren't paying attention, and the shareholders' incentive, once the equity reaches zero, the net value reaches zero, is to start gambling. Well, if they were on the hook for losses beyond the value of their shares, right, if making the bank even deeper into debt would cost something to the shareholders, then they would have different incentives. They wouldn't want to play double or nothing gambles. That's extended liability. So there's double liability, triple liability. In Scotland, they had unlimited liability for all but the banks that had a special charter. There were three banks that had a charter that said limited liability. But otherwise, the banks had unlimited liability. So they were like partnerships legally. And so all the shareholders were liable for all the unpaid debts of the bank. And so the depositors were always paid. There was only one case in which a bank failed and the shareholders were too poor to pay back the depositors. So that's one way, that's a very effective way to reassure depositors. Now, I don't know what the optimal structure of bank liability is, whether it's the ordinary system of single limited liability or double liability or unlimited liability, but the market ought to tell us that. I mean, there are disadvantages to unlimited liability, so I'm not quite sure how the trade-offs work, but in most countries it's been mandatory to have one or the other. And it's very rare that we find a system where banks compete. In the period in Scotland where banks could have either structure, none of the banks wanted to give up unlimited liability. Right? It kind of sends a bad signal to your depositors. We used to stand behind all our debts, now not so much. And last thing, in the United States where banks were weak, they grouped together in clearinghouse associations. Well, the purpose, of course, was mostly to clear checks. But the clearinghouse discovered that each member wanted the other members to be good at the end of the day so that they would pay the debts they owed to the banks that were presenting checks to them. And so clearinghouse associations started imposing membership standards. They began examining their members. So the first bank examinations weren't from the government. They were from the private clearinghouse associations. And then they realize that if a member is running short of liquidity, but they're solvent, so they will be able to pay back the loan if we loan them some reserves, they began to get into the practice of serving as lenders of last resort. this is pretty much limited to the U.S. where the banks were weak. You don't see it in other places. But being a member of the clearinghouse then became a kind of badge to the public that this bank is trustworthy, because it meant that, one, you've been examined and you've been found solvent, and the people who are examining you are not like government examiners. These guys have an incentive to get it right because they're there on behalf of the other banks that you owe money to. And if you do have a random blip where you're running out of reserves, the other members will pitch in. They will stand behind you. So being a member of the clearinghouse was a valuable asset, and the worst thing for a bank would be to be kicked out of the clearinghouse. I mean, that was the sanction. If you don't meet the requirements, you get expelled from the clearinghouse, and then what do your depositors do? They say, "Ooh, that's bad news," and they run the bank. Okay, so let's look at some historic evidence, historical evidence. My favorite example is Canada, which had an economy very much like the United States in the late 19th century. Namely, most people were farmers, and there was a lot of wheat being grown out on the prairies. Okay, the population density isn't quite as high, but very similar economy, except for the banking system. In Canada, the banks were allowed to branch nationwide. In the U.S., they were limited to a single state, and in most states, they weren't allowed to branch. This is called the unit banking system. Each bank had only one office. In the Great Depression, while the U.S. had literally thousands of bank runs, mostly in the rural areas, Canada had none. No panic, no problems. Right? And this is the Great Depression. I mean, it's some serious loan losses, but it didn't bring down any of the banks. In England, as I mentioned before, there was a limit on the number of partners, so banks were undercapitalized. In Scotland, they could have unlimited numbers of partners, so the banks were well capitalized. In England, you had clusters of bank failures. In Scotland, you didn't. Okay, so they overcame the problem by the methods I talked about a minute ago. They were able to credibly assure their depositors that they could survive bad news in Canada, in Scotland, but not in the U.S. because, and not in England, because they were undercapitalized. All right, so I can go into more details about the U.S., but I think I've taken enough time. Let me skip through that. The clearinghouse associations, as I mentioned, acted as lenders of last resort. But maybe I should say one more thing about that. The U.S. could have solved its problems by moving to a Canadian-style banking system, and there were people at the time who proposed that, but it was not politically popular with the small banks. Small banks did not want large banks branching into their neighborhood. And they were very powerful politically because there were so many of them. There were more congressmen who had a small bank in their district than who had a money center bank in their district. That was limited to New York and Chicago. So the Chicago banks were all in favor of a Canadian style system. They'd be able to branch out, but the small banks were against it, and that killed it. Despite the backing of the American Bankers Association proposing this kind of deregulation. So instead, we got the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve was supposed to cure the problem of the panics. This was during what we call the progressive era in the United States. So everybody was turning to the federal government to fix things. And this is one example. Okay, but the worst banking panic takes place, or series of banking panics actually takes place after the Federal Reserve Act is passed. And between 1930 and 1933, there's a series of panics that lead to huge numbers of bank runs and make the money supply shrink, which, as Friedman and Schwartz have explained, was a big reason the Great Depression was so deep. Okay, I said that. So who was in favor of federal deposit insurance? The small banks. The small banks said, we need, because runs on small banks, people knew they were weak, led to deposits flowing out of small banks and into large banks. Well, into large banks or under the mattress. Right? So the money supply was shrinking. But Citibank actually gained deposits during the Great Depression because there was a flight to quality. So the small banks were all in favor of federal deposit insurance. It'll make us just as safe as the large banks, even though fundamentally we're not as safe, we're not as well capitalized, we're not well diversified, but we'll look as safe to depositors, we'll stop losing deposits. The big banks were actually against it, and they warned this will cause moral hazard, this will be a subsidy to bad bankers at the expense of good bankers, you don't want to do that. Well, large banks in the U.S. have accommodated themselves to deposit insurance now, and you would never hear them make that argument now, because they're the riskiest banks. But they made all the right warnings about moral hazard. And it was actually a very close vote, the Federal Deposit Insurance Act. Franklin Roosevelt was actually against it. And he was against it because he had looked at, or one of his advisors had looked at, the experience of deposit insurance at the state level. Almost all the state-funded systems had gone broke. They encouraged so much bad banking that the Deposit Insurance Fund ran out of money paying back the depositors of all the failed banks. But it passed. And of course, federal deposit insurance is a little bit different in the U.S. from state deposit insurance, which is that it's backed by the Federal Reserve System. The Fed can always print enough dollars to pay everybody back. It's a little indirect. The Deposit Insurance Agency has an unlimited line of credit from the Treasury, and the Treasury has an unlimited line of credit from the Fed. But it amounts to the same thing. The FDIC can get the Fed to print all the dollars necessary. It's not really insurance. They call it insurance. It's more of a guarantee, which is not actuarially sound. All right, so they charge banks what they call premiums, but it's actually a tax. Banks pay premiums not only on their insured deposits, but even on their uninsured deposits. Right? There's a limit per account how much is insured, and if you're above the limit, it's uninsured. But banks pay premiums even on the uninsured parts of deposits. And it's unlike insurance in that it's not risk adjusted. It was supposed to be risk-adjusted. There was a reform passed in 1991 which declared that it would be risk-adjusted, but it still isn't risk-adjusted, which means that it still subsidizes risk-taking. Right? So a bank that takes on more risks doesn't have to pay more for deposits the way they would in a system where the depositors were on the hook. It doesn't have deductibles, that is, the first dollar of loss is not felt by the depositor. That's common in auto insurance, right? They want to give the driver an incentive to avoid the accident. So the first 250 euros is on the driver, or 500 euros if you rent from Sixt. There's no co-insurance, that is 100% of the losses are covered, not 90%. And there's effectively no cap. I said there's a limit per deposit, but you can have deposits in as many banks as you like. And so as an individual, you can insure as many millions of dollars as you'd like. Uninsured deposits have been a surprisingly large number. And they've kept the system from being worse, because uninsured depositors do shop around for safe banks. So they do provide an incentive for a bank to be safe. But what we did in the financial crisis was to raise the limit on deposit insurance from $100,000 to $250,000, which made it even easier to avoid having an uninsured deposit. You mentioned Larry Summers and moral hazard. Larry Summers in 2008 famously said, as the United States government was bailing out large banks, now is not the time to worry about moral hazard, which is 100% wrong. That's exactly the time to worry about moral hazard, when you're relieving people from the consequences of their bad decisions. So there's a moral hazard of underpriced deposit guarantees, and that's pretty well understood. I was just at a conference at Bocconi in which several papers about bank regulation began with the premise we have a problem of moral hazard because we have deposit insurance, and now what can we do to reduce the size of the problem? We can't touch deposit insurance, of course, but maybe we can raise capital requirements on banks or impose leverage ratios on banks or something like that. So everybody, it's widely recognized that there's a moral hazard problem. In the financial crisis, we made explicit what was only implicit before, which is a too-big-to-fail policy, which says even the uninsured depositors don't suffer losses. So effectively, everybody's guaranteed. And the reason you don't want them to, the proponents of this don't want them to suffer losses is they're in a position to run. They can flee from banks that they think are weak into banks that they think are protected. And we wouldn't want that because that would penalize banks for being weak. We don't want that. But when everybody's guaranteed, then nobody monitors the bank. It's completely up to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And as we saw in the savings and loan crisis, they have an incentive to think wishfully about whether a bank can survive. Citibank has been insolvent 3 times and nobody has closed it. They've always hoped that it could recover. I think I'm allowed to say that legally since I'm outside the U.S. I mean, there are rules against fomenting bank runs. So I mentioned the FSLI, the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Crisis. The FSLIC went broke because the savings and loan industry had such big losses. And it was actually closed. It's the only government agency that's been closed in my lifetime. But deposit insurance for savings banks, the surviving savings banks, was given to the FDIC. The FDIC had its own problem in 1991. It ran out of money because there were so many bank failures. And at that point, I helped organize a conference on the crisis in American banking. This is the cover of the conference volume, which came out in 93. And I was hoping that the crisis would continue so that we could sell some books. Maybe Citibank would fail. That would be great for sales. It didn't happen. The FDIC borrowed, got a line of credit from the Treasury of $90 billion. I forget how much they exactly borrowed. But the banking industry recovered after 1991. Inflation came down. The yield curve became steeper, and so banks could borrow short and lend long and make profits again, and the industry very rapidly recovered, unfortunately, for sales of my book. So I mentioned that before the FDIC Improvement Act, which was supposed to make the premiums risk-based, it didn't happen. There's political economy reasons for that. It was supposed to impose what was called least cost resolution, that is, the FDIC was prohibited from covering uninsured depositors because that costs taxpayers money. But that's also not been honored in the last financial crisis. There was supposed to be early intervention for banks as their capital ratio fell below certain trigger points. That didn't happen. So in 2007 to 2009, these rules that were imposed on the FDIC were just ignored. And as I said, Citibank became insolvent again. Under the rules, the management should have been discharged, dividend payments, not only their salaries capped, but they should have been fired. Dividend payments should have been frozen, and so on. None of that happened. Alan Meltzer commenting on that. The act authorized regulators to close banks before they lost all their capital. The regulators ignored it. So here's the map of where deposit insurance is today. Right? So I said it spread from the United States to the rest of the world. So basically, 3/4 of all rich countries have it. There are just a few exceptions. Australia being perhaps the most prominent. Although this map is a few years old, so I need to double check whether they've implemented it. But it's less common in poor countries, and that's probably a good thing. This paper by 3 authors whose names I'm not going to try to pronounce sort of studied the actual effect of deposit insurance around the world and found, look, it's the net effect is to reduce banking stability, especially in developing countries where, as they put it, the contracting environment is poorly developed. So basically, it's the moral hazard problem. Depositors stop shopping around for safe banks. The banks have less incentive to behave safely. They take advantage of that. And so it destabilizes the banking system. You get so many more bank failures. Whereas in rich countries, it has little significant effect on stability. Banks already know how to make themselves safe, but deposit insurance, yeah, true, it gives depositors less reason to be nervous, but it also gives banks less reason to be safe, and those seems to be kind of a wash on the number of banking crises you have. So we'll stop there.